Good evening from New York, and welcome to our annual Grand Central Forum. It's a time when we as a community come together in colloquy on important issues of the day, and community takes on greater meaning in these times. With that, allow me to thank each of you, our delegates, and I know several are still filing in. We're speaking today about the future of international arbitration. To answer that, we'll take a look at where we were, where we are now, to inform where we're headed, to the next normal. The cadence becomes, how do we build best practices to really make proceedings more efficient? Will it involve requests for joinder and consolidation, expedited arbitration, and emergency and interim relief? We approach the topic with an all-star group of thought leaders as we focus today on the Americas. Each wears several hats within the IA community, and they'll share their insights on how the pivot or pivots have happened and what nuances are here to stay. Turning to our speakers, Julie Bedard. Julie is a partner at Skadden, Arp, Slate, Meagher, and Flom in their New York office and head of their international litigation and arbitration group for the Americas. She acts as both counsel and independent arbitrator. Like many of our speakers, she is active in bar associations, notably as the Arbitration Committee co-chair of the IBA. And I'm delighted to report that this year Julie was named as an arbitrator for the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreements Dispute Settlement Mechanism. Melita Hodgson. Melita is a partner at Jenner & Block in their New York office and head of the firm's New York International Arbitration Practice. Her counsel practice focuses on investor state and commercial arbitrations, and she also sits as independent arbitrator. Melita has also served as a government litigator with the U.S. Department of Justice, and I'm delighted to celebrate Melita's recent vice chair appointment to the ICC Institute of World Business Law. Jose Emilio Nunez Pinto. Jose is an independent arbitrator and mediator. He is principal at Jose Emilio Nunez Pinto Abogados, a boutique firm that specializes in international arbitration matters. He is a consummate academic, leading training sessions for the ICC and a previous member of the LCIA court. And I'm proud to say he is also a member of NIAC's Global Advisory Board. Tom Sikora. Tom is senior counsel of the International Disputes Group at ExxonMobil Corporation, where he manages international commercial and investment arbitration. Prior to ExxonMobil, he spent 10 years at El Paso Corporation, managing the company's international arbitration and complex litigation. And prior to that, he was counsel at the Disputes Group of Vinson and Elkins in Houston. Last but not least, Grant Hanasian, this afternoon's conductor. Grant is principal at Hanasian ADR. He is also adjunct professor of law at Fordham Law School, and he is chair emeritus of the Arbitration Committee of the USCIB. Two administrative points. This session is being recorded and will soon upload to NIAC's audio library. Next, second, to increase audience participation and engagement, we'll ask you during the Q&A session following the substantive program to use the raise hand feature within Zoom. We then have the option to unmute you. Not to worry, we will not turn on your video, and you can pose the questions live that you wish to present. Separate from that, during the substantive portion, please submit your questions within the Q&A portal, and Grant will adeptly turn to them as appropriate. So, as you consider whether the new normal is the great equalizer, allow me to offer my thanks to the Foley-Hoag team for running the Zoom platform. And now, to turn the floor over to Grant. Grant, please take it away.
Thank you very much, Rekha. Thank you all for joining. This is the third of our Grand Central Forum sessions for today. We began in the morning with a session focused on Asia and midday, Europe and Middle East, and now we conclude with focusing on the Americas, and grateful to all the panelists for taking time to be with us here today to talk about the future. Will the future look like these last 7 months? Are these changes that we're seeing, are they durable and enduring or not? And we'll consider various procedural aspects of the way we work and consider it in that context. So we'll jump right in. and ask Melina to focus first for us on procedural conferences, oral arguments. These now, of course, are done just as we're doing this. And will we continue to do this when we can all move around more freely again?
Thank you, Grant. And thank you certainly to NIAC for having invited me to participate. I'm very honored to be joining with such esteemed colleagues in participating in today's panel, or this afternoon's panel. You know, in terms of whether or not we'll see procedural conferences sort of go the way of Zoom or video conferencing, not to to give Zoom too much credit, but I think we will. I think the irony of all of this is that we were already mostly, at least in my experience, on teleconferences for first meeting with the tribunal and other sorts, most other procedural conferences. What COVID has done, pandemic has done, is actually move us into video for that. So it's closer to the real thing or what maybe used to happen 10 years ago. So I thought that was an interesting development, is instead of just doing that by conference call, now I see more and more that what we're doing is actually video conferencing. I think when you get into the other areas, like oral arguments, whether it be at jurisdictional hearings or the hearings, substantive hearings themselves, that's going to be more complicated, and particularly looking at it through the Latin American lens. I think the technology is there, but my reality is that the technology doesn't necessarily work for my clients. So it can all work, you know, the capacity is there, but if you have to bring people in from different countries, I mean, I have WhatsApp calls with my clients, right? Because that's the best way they can connect. They don't have the same facilities or capabilities in terms of the technology. That's fine if you're just doing a call to discuss strategy. It's very different if you want to be present for an hour or two in a hearing setting. I personally don't think the capacity is there, particularly in investment arbitration, where you're dealing with states that have very limited budgets and you're dealing with public servants who aren't going to have the same capabilities that those of us who work for law firms have at home in terms of video conferencing capabilities. So, you know, I recall that, you know, we've had instances where before this, we would bring in a witness who, for whatever reason, just could not travel, a minister or someone who was minister of a ministry, you know, someone who had heart condition or something like that. And it was already difficult to set up to do a VC with that person and to do the cross-examination and all of the sort of assurances that you went through that it would be fair and the person wouldn't be coached and all of that, which, of course, if we're dealing with COVID restrictions, I'm not sure we can imitate. Now, what my understanding is that this can all work just beautifully and you have breakout rooms, et cetera, but again, my perception is that if you're dealing with people who have to come from Latin America, that could be more difficult. And then I think it's important for us to remember we're the lawyers, we're not the clients, we're not the parties, we're not their actual representatives, we're their legal representatives. And so, you know, I think it raises questions going further than a procedural meeting or perhaps a very, very short oral hearing. I think it raises questions of due process. I'll stop there.
Okay. It's a good provocative opening there. Reactions from others on, well, it could be, you know, that arbitrators, counsel, and the parties all have separate perspectives on these matters. In our midday session, Emmanuel Gaillard spoke and seemed quite content to continue to do hearings as arbitrator and or counsel from his home office, shall we say. It may be that clients have different views on these matters.
Yes, Tom. I'll raise one point, if I may, Grant, which is in complicated investor state cases, with multiple parties or with difficult sovereigns, you know, we actually tend to do the preliminary hearing or the case management conference in person, and often travel great distances to do so, because I think there's tremendous value in such cases of actually meeting face to face and having everyone in the same room. And I think we will continue to do so. But in other cases that do not have these characteristics and these complications, I think it's a huge upgrade to do it via video conference than do it the way we used to do it, which was simply by phone.
I agree with that. I think Melita pointed out this aspect early in her presentation. It's an upgrade overall. One comment about your last reference to due process, Melita, which I think is not insignificant, right? So even if we are talking about an upgrade generally from phone to video, then this is maybe more significant for merits hearings, and we will be addressing that later. But I think that there's now been a little bit more of a debate around people participating in various time zones and making things happen, making hearings happen at all costs, because somehow it's really possible for all to get on at whichever hour of the day or the night. And I do think that for some clients in some situations that may be pushing the envelope, particularly if it requires a client to be, you know, up in the middle of the night, which raises the due process concerns. And we'll circle back on the merits conversation. I think it's definitely more significant there. But there's a lot of peer pressure now to participate by video conference and make sure that we're all on, so to speak, to move the ball forward. And generally, that's the way to go. But there are some valid exceptions to that.
Does anyone think that there will be more midstream conferences, more case management conferences, more sort of checking in using video conferencing? Jose Emilio.
I think Jose Emilio has something to add.
Yeah, I really appreciate all that. I think each case is a different case for the time being. I was in a hearing in person here in Sao Paulo with 85 people sitting in a hotel room when WHO declared pandemics. We dismissed immediately and we resumed the hearing 5 days later by Zoom. It was a surprise because the video made the difference. It was a hearing on substantive matters. We had witnesses being examined and cross-examined by counsel. And what we had at that time, what I would say, we simply transferred the hotel room to Zoom. We did not take any measure to allow us to properly address a hearing like this by video. I see what you mean. I agree with you. I still think that what we have in place, we are simply trying to replicate by video what we do in person. But my question is, this discussion is not new. If you go backwards to 2018 Queen Mary survey, you'll see, I'm sure, that 96% of those responding to the survey said, we want more technology. We want more virtual meetings. And one of the worst aspects of arbitration is indeed the cost. And the cost is related to hearings in person. Of course, we have to have a balance. We have to strike a balance because this is not all true and all false. I think the real question now is, we as arbitrators, counsel, we express our views, what we think. But the real question to be answered is, who will take the lead to determine the future of virtual hearings? For me, this is the very point.
Grant, if I could say something to that, I have heard, obviously, of some tribunals deciding to go ahead, even if one party does not want to go ahead with a virtual hearing. I think, again, in the investment arbitration context, we're waiting, I believe, for ICSID to make a decision on Spain's challenge to an entire tribunal because the tribunal decided to go ahead with a virtual hearing instead of a live one or in person, I should say. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens there. There are obviously a number of factors, whether or not one of the arbitrators could actually travel or two of them could actually travel, quarantine issues. There are all of those sort of sub-issues, but I think the bigger issue is, does this substantively change? Yes, everything is within the arbitrator's discretion and power, but is this so much of a change in power and what parties expect that it's a bridge too far? So I think, we'll have a better idea after we get that decision, which I don't think has come out yet from the World Bank.
There's a lot on the table, so we can sort of talk about all these things at once, I think. But in its very early days, we're, of course, generally, we're 7 months into this pandemic, and there have certainly been commercial cases where the tribunal has gone ahead, notwithstanding an objection of a party, to have an online hearing, and it may be too early to draw any definitive conclusions about national court reactions to this, but we do know that a lot of national courts are operating virtually. And as far as I know, there have not been any national court decisions that have interfered with the tribunal's ability to hold a hearing online over an objection. But maybe I will ask this group, is anybody on this panel aware of any national court interference with such a thing? Would you expect that in Latin America, that you'd have a due process, for lack of a better term, a successful due process challenge by a party to a tribunal's decision to go forward in national courts of any Latin American state?
Maybe as background to answer this question, Grant, the IBA had conducted a survey on due process as a ground to vacate or deny the recognition of the award, right? And this was a worldwide survey. It's very difficult to do it. There really isn't much traction in the courts for judges to substitute their judgment to that of the arbitrators when it comes to managing the case and adjudicating the case and giving justice to the parties. So I think I would not expect that to change, even with maybe a little bit more pressure on the system. But I would also think that there will be more, extreme circumstances where some courts may be inclined to hear the argument and possibly even grant it. But, I heard of one case that certainly gave me pause because I'm personally in favor of trying to move the ball forward, generally speaking, unless there's really an issue. But when you see clients having to participate in merits hearings in the middle of the night for a week straight, that doesn't make sense to me.
time zone issues. I mean, this is obviously in some cases, you know, it can be quite onerous. What is the experience of this group in terms of late nights? I mean, I'm involved in a case where we have parties in Asia and the U.S., and we've decided that no one should have to work after 11 o'clock local time. Has anybody had circumstances where people have had to work later than that in their own time? Just a matter of curiosity.
It's not the working late. It's the getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Well, yeah, nobody had to get up before six. Six a.m. was the earliest somebody would have to appear, I suppose.
So yeah. I've had to get up rather early for an entire week, and my sense is it just really doesn't work, and it's not fair to one party, and I can't imagine a tribunal in the future, absent truly exigent circumstances, ordering a virtual hearing with a time zone difference so extreme and so punitive to oneself.
I have one case between Brazil, U.S., and Europe. I have to admit that it's not easy. It's difficult. It's a 5-hour time difference between Brazil and Europe, 6-hour difference between U.S. and Europe, and the duration of the session has to be reduced, although in the end you start, let's say, here in Brazil at 8 o'clock, it's 1 o'clock in Paris, so we go up to 9 o'clock in Paris. It's 4 o'clock here. We have the breaks, but it is extremely, extremely difficult. Because you cannot take for granted that you sit down in front of your screen at 8 o'clock in the morning, you go through for in the afternoon. The same on the other side of the pond. So I think the time difference is an important element to be taken into account.
What about for smaller cases? And the ICC, is I'm sure many of the attendees know, is about to change its rules effective January 1. The expedited rules will cover cases with a value of $3 million or less. So you'll have a sole arbitrator and the case will be completed in 6 months. Do you think that virtual hearings will become more the norm for smaller cases? I'm not picking the number 3 million U.S. necessarily, but for smaller cases generally. People think. Tom, what do you think from the client standpoint?
Well, I was about to make a joke that I'm in the energy business. I don't have any small cases. Having said that, about 25 years ago, my first ICC case in London was over a claim of $1 million. And I'm amazed that it went to a full merits hearing and resulted in a full award. I think our, you know, if I had to guess, my view is that if we had cases for $5 million or less, we would very much support the idea of virtual hearings because, you know, for those cases, costs drive everything.
Any other views about as an arbitrator, is it appropriate to insist in a smaller case that the parties do this virtually over objection? Once we are able to all travel freely again, any views about that?
I think that those rules have to be tested. They are new. They were new. They had enormous success in certain cases. That's why the threshold was increased. But we have to take into account so many changes at the same time, it's not easy. Virtual hearings, midstream conferences, small cases, expedited cases. I think we have to relax and see what will happen. We have, I think we only have a better picture. That's my, I am convinced. When we have a clear picture of what's going on with the pandemic. That's my convincement. I may be wrong. I may be too old for that. But that's my view.
You know, Grant, if I can just add to that, I mean, even under the current, at least ICC expedited procedures, live hearings are sort of discouraged anyway. So frankly, again, this may be one of those cases where you have an upgrade, whereas before, instead of just getting a decision on the papers, maybe you actually get some kind of a video conference hearing because it's cheap enough to do, but it would be efficient. And so it fits within the goals or the objectives of the ICC in terms of having expedited procedures. So, you know, it may be that it becomes something that, whereas you otherwise would not have had a hearing, you do now, or a live hearing.
Just to briefly return to this issue of conference, you know, the procedural conferences, and Tom's point about physically gathering for the first conference, and maybe this is the distinction with very, very large cases, and the advantages of getting together and having the respective parties in the same room, and possibly there's an opportunity for settlement discussion while everybody's physically in the same place. But on the other hand, you also hear stories, and I'm sure we've all participated in this, where everyone has traveled a great distance for what's effectively a two-hour conference going over a PO1 or a terms of reference. I mean, as a client, Tom, would you insist on physical first conferences? Do you think that's something that you would insist on in a certain case?
Generally speaking, I would not. Generally speaking, preliminary conferences are done virtually, but in many cases, there are difficult jurisdictional issues. There are issues of sorting out the parties. There may be a difficult state on the other side, and we do not know what objections or preliminary objections the state will make. And it's just worth doing that first conference in person. And again, when you have a multi-billion-dollar case, the difference between a virtual or an in-person preliminary conference is not really going to break the budget. But I would, again, reserve those in-person preliminary conferences for very large and procedurally and structurally difficult proceedings.
What about more midstream conferences, just before we leave the topic? Are we seeing more of these in these 7 months? In the beginning there was talk about, well, there'll be a lot more opportunity for arbitrators to touch base with the parties, and maybe arbitrators will have more time because hearings were canceled in the early days. But are we seeing this? Do we expect that this will occur generally in the Americas?
From my viewpoint, I'm not sure that we're seeing them increasing in great numbers just yet. But I do think that we're probably seeing positive developments that predate COVID and will be just strengthened and supported by the further use of video conference. And that is substantive presentations about the cases at the opening case management conference. Because I think we went through many years of not having any kind of substance in our preliminary conferences, and I personally favor having some substance in the case management conference. And I think we're starting to see that, and the video will help greatly. Same thing for the midstream conferences. I think that the arbitrators are incentivized to take more ownership of the case, break down the issues, force counsel to really articulate, break down their cases in the way perhaps that they weren't necessarily doing for a long time, which is fine. That too is furthered by the use of the video conference technology. And the other thing I would add in that sort of midstream category, Grant, is I think many of us are familiar with the failure of pre-arbitration dispute resolution clauses, either in negotiation or mediation, that just fail. I think for the most part, because the parties have not yet been able to study the ins and outs of their cases sufficiently to allow them to make the economic assessments about, you know, risk, exposure, benefits of the arbitration, who may win, who may lose what. And when you do this midstream, you're much better equipped with the information about your case on both sides to permit perhaps this